This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Ted DeLorme, Fort Mill, South Carolina, August 2006. Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town by Stephen Leacock. Chapter 9. The Mariposa Bank Mystery. Suicide is a thing that ought not to be committed without very careful thought. It often involves serious consequences, and in some cases brings pain to others than oneself. I don't say that there is no justification for it. There often is. Anybody who has listened to certain kinds of music, or read certain kinds of poetry, or heard certain kinds of performances upon the concertina will admit that there are some lives which ought not to be continued, and that even suicide has its brighter aspects. But to commit suicide on grounds of love is, at the best, a very dubious experiment. I know that in this I am expressing an opinion contrary to that of most true lovers, who embrace suicide on the slightest provocation as the only honorable termination of an existence that never ought to have begun. I quite admit that there is a glamour and a sensation about the thing, which has its charm, and there is nothing like it for causing a girl to realize the value of the heart that she has broken, and which breathed forgiveness upon her at the very moment when it held in its hand the half-pint of prussic acid that was to terminate its beating forever. But apart from the general merits of the question, I suppose there are few people outside of lovers who know what it is to commit suicide 4 times in 5 weeks. Yet this is what happened to Mr. Pupkin of the Exchange Bank of Mariposa. Ever since he had known Zena Pepperleigh, he had realized that his love for her was hopeless. She was too beautiful for him, and too good for him. Her father hated him, and her mother despised him. His salary was too small, and his own people were too rich. If you add to all that that he came up to the judge's house one night and found a poet reciting verses to Zena, you will understand the suicide at once. It was one of those regular poets with a solemn jackass face and lank parted hair and eyes like puddles of molasses. I don't know how he came there, up from the city probably, but there he was on the Pepperleigh's veranda that August evening. He was reciting poetry, either Tennyson's or Shelley's or his own, you couldn't tell. And about him sat Zena with her hands clasped, and Nora Gallagher looking at the sky, and Jocelyn Drone gazing into infinity, and a little tubby woman looking at the poet with her head falling over sideways. In fact, there was a whole group of them. I don't know what it is about poets that draws women to them in this way, but everybody knows that a poet has only to sit and saw the air with his hands and recite verses in a deep, stupid voice, and all the women are crazy over him. Men despise him and would kick him off the veranda if they dared, but the women simply rave over him. So Pupkin sat there in the gloom and listened to this poet reciting Browning, and he realized that everybody understood it but him. He could see Zena with her eyes fixed on the poet, as if she were hanging on to every syllable. She was. She needed to. And he stood it just about 15 minutes, and then slid off the side of the veranda and disappeared without even saying good night. He walked straight down Oneida Street and along the main street just as hard as he could go. There was only one purpose in his mind. Suicide. He was heading straight for Jim Elliott's drugstore on the main corner, and his idea was to buy a drink of chloroform and drink it and die right there on the spot. As Pupkin walked down the street, the whole thing was so vivid in his mind that he could picture it to the remotest detail. He could even see it all in type, in big headings in the newspapers of the following day. Appalling suicide. Peter Pupkin poisoned. He perhaps hoped that the thing might lead to some kind of public inquiry, and that the question of Browning's poetry, and whether it is altogether fair to allow of its general circulation, would be fully ventilated in the newspapers. Thinking of that, Pupkin came to the main corner. On a warm August evening, the drugstore of Mariposa, as you know, is all a blaze of lights. You can hear the hissing of the soda water fountain half a block away, and inside the store there are ever so many people, boys and girls and old people too, all drinking sarsaparilla and chocolate sundaes and lemon sours and foaming drinks that you take out of long straws. There is such a laughing and a talking as you never heard, and the girls are all in white and pink and Cambridge blue, and the soda fountain is of white marble with silver taps, and it hisses and sputters, and Jim Elliot and his assistant wear white coats with red geraniums in them, and it's just as gay as gay. The foyer of the opera in Paris may be a fine sight, but I doubt if it can compare with the inside of Elliot's drugstore in Mariposa for real gaiety and joy of living. This night the store was especially crowded because it was a Saturday, and that meant early closing for all the hotels, except, of course, Smith's. So as the hotels were shut, the people were all in the drugstore, drinking like fishes. It just shows the folly of local option and the temperance movement and all that. Why, if you shut the hotels, you simply drive the people to the soda fountains, and there's more drinking than ever, and not only of the men, too, but the girls and young boys and children. I've seen little things of 8 and 9 that had to be lifted up on the high stools at Elliot's drugstore, drinking great goblets of lemon soda, enough to burst them, brought there by their own fathers. And why? Simply because the hotel bars were shut. What's the use of thinking you can stop people drinking merely by cutting off whiskey and brandy? The only effect is to drive them to taking lemon sour and sarsaparilla and cherry pectoral and Carioca cordial and things they wouldn't have touched before. So in the long run, they drink more than ever. The point is that you can't prevent people having a good time, no matter how hard you try. If they can't have it with lager beer and brandy, they'll have it with plain soda and lemon pop. And so the whole gloomy scheme of the temperance people breaks down anyway. But I was only saying that Elliot's drugstore in Mariposa on a Saturday night is the gayest and brightest spot in the world. And just imagine what a fool of a place to commit suicide in. Just imagine going up to the soda water fountain and asking for 5 cents worth of chloroform and soda. Well, you simply can't, that's all. That's the way Pupkin found it. You see, as soon as he came in, somebody called out, "Hello, Pete!" And one or two others called, "Hello, Pup!" And some said, "How goes it?" And others, "How are you toughing it?" And so on. Because, you see, they had all been drinking, more or less, and naturally they felt jolly and glad-hearted. So the upshot of it was that instead of taking chloroform, Pupkin stepped up to the counter of the fountain, and he had a Bromo seltzer with cherry soda. And after that, he had one of those aerated seltzers, and then a couple of lemon seltzers and a Bromo fizzer. I don't know if you know the mental effect of a Bromo seltzer, but it's a hard thing to commit suicide on. You can't. You feel so buoyant. Anyway, what with the fizzing of the seltzer and the lights and the girls, Pupkin began to feel so fine that he didn't care a cuss for all the Browning in the world. And as for the poet, oh, to blazes with him. What's poetry anyway? Only rhymes. So, would you believe it, in about 10 minutes, Peter Pupkin was off again and heading straight for the Pepperleys' house, poet or no poet. And what was more to the point, he carried with him 3 great bricks of Elliot's ice cream in green, pink, and brown layers. He struck the veranda just at the moment when Browning was getting too stale and dreary for words. His brain was all sizzling and jolly with the bromo seltzer, and when he fetched out the ice cream bricks and Zena ran to get plates and spoons to eat it with, and Pupkin went with her to help her fetch them, and they picked out the spoons together, they were so laughing and happy that it was just a marvel. Girls, you know, need no bromo seltzer. They're full of it all the time. And as for the poet, well, can you imagine how Pupkin felt when Zena told him that the poet was married and that the tubby little woman with her head on sideways was his wife? So they had the ice cream, and the poet ate it in buckets full. Poets always do. They need it. And after it, the poet recited some stanzas of his own, and Pupkin saw that he had misjudged the man because it was dandy poetry, the very best. That night, Pupkin walked home on air, and there was no thought of chloroform, and it turned out that he hadn't committed suicide, but, like all lovers, he had commuted it. I don't need to describe in full the later suicides of Mr. Pupkin, because they were all conducted on the same plan and rested on something the same reasons as above. Sometimes he would go down at night to the offices of the bank below his bedroom and bring up his bank revolver in order to make an end of himself with it. This, too, he could see headed up in the newspapers as Brilliant Boy Banker Blows Out Brains. But blowing out your brains is a noisy, rackety performance, and Pupkin soon found that only special kinds of brains are suited for it. So he always sneaked back again later in the night and put the revolver in its place, deciding to drown himself instead. Yet every time that he walked down to the trestle bridge over the Ossawippi, he found it was quite unsuitable for drowning, too high, and the water too swift and black, and the rushes too gruesome. In fact, not at all the kind of place for a drowning. Far better, he realized, to wait there on the railroad track and throw himself under the wheels of the express and be done with it. Yet, though Pupkin often waited in this way for the train, he was never able to pick out a pair of wheels that suited him. Anyhow, it's awfully hard to tell an express from a fast freight. I wouldn't mention these attempts at suicide if one of them hadn't finally culminated in making Peter Pupkin a hero and solving for him the whole perplexed entanglement of his love affair with Zena Pepperleigh. Incidentally, it threw him into the very center of one of the most impenetrable bank mysteries that ever baffled the ingenuity of some of the finest legal talent that ever adorned one of the most enterprising communities in the country. It happened one night, as I say, that Pupkin decided to go down into the office of the bank and get his revolver and see if it would blow his brains out. It was the night of the fireman's ball, and Zena had danced 4 times with a visitor from the city, a man who was in the 4th year at the university and who knew everything. It was more than Peter Pupkin could bear. Mallory Tompkins was away that night, and when Pupkin came home, he was all alone in the building, except for Gillis, the caretaker, who lived in the extension at the back. He sat in his room for hours, brooding. 2 or 3 times he picked up a book. He remembered afterwards distinctly that it was Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and tried to read it, but it seemed meaningless and trivial. Then, with a sudden access of resolution, he started from his chair and made his way down the stairs and into the office room of the bank, meaning to get a revolver and kill himself on the spot and let them find his body lying on the floor. It was then far on in the night, and the empty building of the bank was as still as death. Pupkin could hear the stairs creak under his feet, and as he went he thought he heard another sound, like the opening or closing of a door, but it sounded not like the sharp, ordinary noise of a closing door, but with a dull, muffled noise, as if someone had shut the iron door of a safe in a room under the ground. For a moment Pupkin stood and listened with his heart thumping against his ribs. Then he kicked his slippers from his feet and without a sound stole into the office on the ground floor and took the revolver from his teller's desk. As he gripped it, he listened to the sounds on the back stairway and in the vaults below. I should explain that in the Exchange Bank of Mariposa, the offices are on the ground floor level with the street. Below this is another floor with low, dark rooms paved with flagstones, with unused office desks and with piles of papers stored in boxes. On this floor are the vaults of the bank, and lying in them in the autumn, the grain season, there is anything from $50,000 to $100,000 in currency tied in bundles. There is no other light down there than the dim reflection from the lights out on the street that lies in patches on the stone floor. I think, as Peter Pupkin stood, revolver in hand, in the office of the bank, he had forgotten all about the maudlin purpose of his first coming. He had forgotten for the moment all about heroes and love affairs, and his whole mind was focused, sharp and alert, with the intensity of the nighttime, on the sounds that he heard in the vault and on the back stairway of the bank. Straight away, Pupkin knew what it meant as plainly as if it were written in print. He had forgotten, I say, about being a hero, and he only knew that there was $60,000 in the vault of the bank below, and that he was paid $800 a year to look after it. As Peter Pupkin stood there, listening to the sounds in his stockinged feet, his face showed gray as ashes in the light that fell through the window from the street. His heart beat like a hammer against his ribs, but behind its beatings was the blood of 4 generations of loyalists, and the robber who would take that $60,000 from the Mariposa Bank must take it over the dead body of Peter Pupkin, teller. Pupkin walked down the stairs to the lower room, the one below the ground with the bank vault in it, with as fine a step as any of his ancestors showed on parade. And if he had known it, as he came down the stairway in the front of the vault room, there was a man crouched in the shadow of the passageway by the stairs at the back. This man, too, held a revolver in his hand, and, criminal or not, his face was as resolute as Pupkin's own. As he heard the teller's step on the stair, he turned and waited in the shadow of the doorway without a sound.